Welcome to today's program titled Protecting Confidential Information and Client Relationships in the Financial Services Industry. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, type your question in the box, and click send. The presentation materials are located in the Handouts tab underneath the Conference Materials pod. This presentation has been prepared by Seyfarth Shaw, LLP, for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form sent with the login information email. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. At this time, I would like to turn it over to Jason Steele, Scott Humphrey, and Rebecca Woods. You may begin.
Thank you very much. Good morning, good afternoon to all of you out there. I'm Jason Steele. I will be covering the first part of the presentation. The second part will be covered by my partner in Washington, D.C., Rebecca Woods, who is a certified privacy professional. And then we'll conclude with Scott Humphrey, who will go through the more specifics on FINRA and the arbitrations. The topics we're going to cover today over the next 45 minutes to an hour include just a general background on who we are at Seyfarth on the trade secret group, what trade secrets or how they're generally defined, and then we'll move on to more specifically what financial services companies can do to protect their specific trade secrets and confidential information, and then we'll conclude with the FINRA issues that I mentioned earlier. So we'll start first with trade secret, and before I get into that, I do want to just give you a quick background. Our trade secret group here at Seyfarth Shaw contains over 60 individuals litigating across the country from New York, to Chicago, Boston, D.C., Los Angeles, and as well as our other offices. We care a lot about this issue and spend a lot of time on it, not because it's fast moving and interesting to us, but it's one that's been pervasive throughout the country lately. I usually have stats in this, and I did not include it in this particular webinar, but I do want to just bring to everybody's attention that it's become a hot topic across the federal judiciary and legislature. And recently, the president has identified in his economic report to Congress that over 70% of the value of publicly traded companies can be found in their intangible assets, such as trade secrets. And recently, the director of National Security Agency, Keith Alexander, in 2010, stated that the value of intellectual property is worth $5 trillion to the U.S. economy, approximately $300 billion of which is stolen by employees every year. And not surprisingly, then we found that in the United States, the number of cases for trade secret misappropriation has doubled between 1995 and 2004, and it's expected to double again by the year 2017. So, with that as a background, let me do a quick overview of what a trade secret is. As one of our courts here has defined it, it is one of the most elusive and difficult concepts in the law to define. And that's simply because there are so many different ways that companies keep, maintain, and utilize their confidential information. And so it's really a fact-specific and fact-intensive exercise that needs to happen under each company's umbrella. So what is a trade secret? There's a uniform definition that has been adopted for the most part by 48 states now. And in essence, those states define misappropriation and define who can be liable and what the penalties for misappropriating the trade secrets are. As it says here on the slide, 48 states have now adopted it. Texas is the most recent. One thing that's worth noting is that Massachusetts and New York don't follow it. However, the common law interpretation is very similar to the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. And I do want to mention that in Massachusetts, there's some current issues brewing. They've been trying to push through a anti-non-compete statute in Massachusetts. And basically, there's been horse trading between the governor and the legislature in Massachusetts for a non-compete ban in return for a trade secret statute. So we're keeping our eyes on that, but that died in house in July. So we won't expect anything until next year on that issue. The formal definition, which, as I said, is adopted by the majority of the states, they define trade secrets as information including a formula, pattern, compilation, program, device, method, technique, or process that derives independent economic value, actual or potential, from not being generally known to and not being readily ascertainable by proper means by other persons who can obtain economic value from its disclosure or use, and is subject to efforts that are reasonable under the circumstances to maintain the secrecy. That's a long, winded way of saying basically anything that you've developed on your own that has value to you and is not known to others and which you take efforts to keep secret most likely will constitute a trade secret. And of course, we summarize it in the next slide. So what we find to be a secret is things not known in the industry generally and things that another person couldn't reverse engineer given time, effort, or expense. What is often forgotten, both by the companies and frankly when we get into litigation, is the second aspect, which is it has to be kept a secret. So you may think you have the greatest thing since sliced bread, but if you don't have the proper measures in place that Rebecca's going to talk about later, there's a good chance that a court may find that despite its value to you, your failure to protect it will lose its trade secret status. Again, those measures need to be reasonable under the circumstances, which varies from company to company and circumstance to circumstance. Specific to y'all on the phone is examples of financial services materials that courts may find to be trade secrets. And I'll go through the list quickly, and obviously if there's any questions more specific to your particular company or industry subsection, feel free to shoot those to us throughout the call, and we'll try to do our best to answer them at the end. But from a high level, we look at things like internal customer and supplier lists, for example, high trading or high net worth clients and their order histories. For institutional fund clients, pension fund clients, portfolio allocations, obviously those are things that companies keep highly confidential and would be a great asset to a competitor if they had their hands on them. Likewise, angel or venture capital investors, their identities and their propensities when interacting with a company. Likewise, more technical type things like internal modeling documents, cash flow forecast models, options and futures pricing models, underwriting models, and analytical compilations and modeling. Finally, internal kind of planning and review documents such as opportunities and trends, SWOT analyses, future private equity targets, and emerging market information. Things that will not be considered a trade secret. And obviously, again, we like to consider it from both sides because it helps us and helps you figure out where to spend your time and efforts in protecting your information. So things that will not be considered trade secrets are things that are publicly available and what we like to refer to as scratch the surface information, such as documents and information found in the Wall Street Journal, third-party abstracts that are publicly available, or information that's placed out on blogs or message boards. I want to make a side note here, and I think it'll be covered in more detail later, but the flurry of online activity such as blogs, Twitter, Facebook, those kinds of things, creates an unusual and unique circumstance for trade secret protection that all companies should be focused on, and frankly, all companies should have policies regarding, if you don't already have them, obviously, as soon as possible. So things that are also not considered trade secrets include off-the-shelf software programs. So if you've purchased unimproved credit risk or insurance risk programs or Excel spreadsheets with generic formulae, those will not be considered. With that said, a lot of our clients, and I'm sure many of you out there, will take off-the-shelf programs and modify them or create your own more complex formulations. Those are things that need to be protected and most likely will keep their status as trade secrets if they are properly protected. So practical steps. This is here just for amusement purposes only, but obviously we've all been on planes and we know how common it is for folks to work on the plane and not to think about protecting their information. So it should be pervasive throughout what you do every day as a company that you are ensuring that your employees are taking every step necessary to protect your information. So back, like I said, the second aspect, we need to ensure that we don't let public disclosure of our information, any public disclosure of a trade secret, very likely will destroy that status as a trade secret. And I'll give you an example. We mentioned the Ruckelshaus case, but in some more recent cases with the onset of internet and media, there are situations where a employee will post something to a Twitter account, post something to their Facebook, which is something you would not want in the public. And frankly, maybe the employee didn't even think about it being quote unquote public. But the minute it's out there, you can't pull it back, and there's a lot of courts out there will find that that posting will eviscerate the status as a trade secret. So likewise, you find that a lot of cases out there, like the Lexmark case, which talk about it's axiomatic that you can't have a trade secret without maintaining its secrecy. So we talked about that one of the factors, it has to be reasonable. So what level of security is required? Absolute secrecy and heroics are not required. They just have to be reasonable under the circumstances. However, if you find out that a trade secret has gotten out, the barn door has been opened, you need to take every effort to quickly and efficiently minimize the damage and ensure that it doesn't get further spread than it already has. Otherwise, you may compromise the value forever. And at that point, I'd like to turn it over to Rebecca Woods, who will keep going.
All right. Thank you, Jason. All right, so this is a bit of an historical slide. It is mostly addressed to the analog steps that companies should consider in terms of general go-to protections for trade secrets, which, unlike things like patents and copyright protections, that you have protection no matter the disclosure, you have to actually take proactive steps to demonstrate things are trade secrets. Those analog world things include agreements with employees, employee policies and handbooks. That also includes training. Training of employees cannot be overstated. Having confidentiality agreements in place with third parties and being particularly attuned to third parties with whom you are engaged in business ventures and by necessity need to share some sort of trade secrets. I'm going to skip over the network and facility bullet because we're going to get into the new world. But additionally, analog-wise, you're going to want to post notices or label materials as confidential or for internal use only, and then, of course, pertinent to many of the folks on this call. If your company has signed the protocol for broker recruiting, that raises some issues. Scott will address those in particular later. But we're now in a new world where a substantial part of modern business is doing business on, through, and with the cloud. Now, I've put up here, a lot of people think generically of the cloud, don't really know what it is or have a fuzzy idea. I've put up here a brain-numbing definition by the National Institute of Standards and Technology of the cloud. And again, these kinds of things aren't particularly helpful. So let's talk about the ways in which the cloud is actually used, because as you're guiding your companies or you're participating in business ventures, you need to be aware of what actually could be a cloud-based platform. There are three models for cloud service. The first one is software service, and that's basically where you use cloud computing to perform software functions. Some examples include NYSE's Euronext Capital Markets Community Platform, the NASDAQ OMX, Google Docs is probably most universally recognized by folks. The next model is called platform as service, and that's simply where the service the web developers use to build and publish applications using the cloud provider's infrastructure. One very common example is Microsoft Azure. I think something on the order of 50% of Fortune 500 companies are using that program. Finally, you have infrastructure as service, and this is where providers own and maintain key computing resources that users rent. iBanks, for example, are using the cloud for risk analysis and other non-core processes. We also have Amazon's EC2 and Rackspace. Now, the cloud is going to be increasingly predominant in business conduct, and there's a lot of reasons for that. It provides tremendous cost savings, scalability, time to market, It allows great internal and external collaboration. It provides increased remote employee access and significant scalability. So the cloud will become more predominant, and it poses its own unique risks to trade secret protection. The three primary sources of risk for using cloud computing platforms are cloud providers themselves, hackers, which are very visible, particularly given significant publicity around the Target, around the Sony PlayStation hacking issues, and then finally rogue and sloppy employees. Hackers are very visible, but they're actually not as common in terms of trade secret risk. By and far, the greatest trade secret risk source is from rogue and sloppy employees. So what do you do to protect your trade secrets with vis-a-vis your cloud providers? There are four general points that I'll note. The first one is that you should research your cloud computing provider's security features. You need to know where and how your information is stored. You need to know whether that cloud provider is using advanced security features such as encryption or two-phase authentication. You need to know what kind of security lapses have occurred in the past and what measures they've taken to address those in the future. The additional thing you should do is negotiate maximum protection terms of service. You're going to have boilerplate terms first foisted upon you, and the effort will be for your company to negotiate greater protections for your company. For example, many contracts automatically provide cloud providers with full access to all of the information you provide to them on their servers. So it's a good idea, if you have negotiating leverage, to try and negotiate limits on their access to your files. And even if you're not successful, if you can demonstrate you made that effort, again, if you wind up in litigation down the road, you can demonstrate your reasonable efforts to protect those trade secrets. You should also consider requiring the provider to delete all of your information at the end of your contract. And you might also want to consider changing your liability provisions. You may not be successful in doing that, but at least by engaging in that process, you know your risk moving forward. You want to make sure the cloud provider provides you with a confidentiality agreement, both for the provider itself and for all the employees the cloud provider gives access to your data. And you want to prohibit them from sharing that data. And finally, an unheralded aspect of modern protection of trade secrets and of any information on the web is to get cyber insurance. Standard insurance policies like CGL policies almost certainly will not provide you and your company protection. And your cloud provider's terms of service will probably limit their liability to damages caused by loss of information. So you're going to want to make sure that you get extra protection through your cyber insurance policies, talk to a broker, for things like business interruption, consequential damages, third-party liability, notification requirements, things of that nature. All right, moving on to how to protect yourself from hacker risks. A key aspect to hacker protection is encryption of your data on the cloud. This provides a significant added layer of protection. It can be costly, it can be time-consuming, but newer technology is coming out that is making this an easier process. Encryption is also super helpful because to the extent that your company has notification obligations in the instance of a hack or theft or loss of data, encryption is typically a protection that protects you from your company from having to provide widespread disclosures. You'll want to consider using two-step or multi-factor authentication, and that's simply where you combine things like username and password and then perhaps a token code that changes every minute. And finally, you're going to want to stay vigilant about cloud providers' security features, and again, make sure that you're staying up on the degree to which they are employing state-of-the-art technologies to protect your information. Okay, and finally, the bigger aspect of the risk posed to companies are the rogue and sloppy employees. There are a number of approaches that can be taken. The first one is to limit your access to trade secrets on a need-to-know basis, because quite sensibly, the fewer people with access, the more likely those secrets will remain secret. You're also going to want to limit access of employee use of non-approved cloud solutions. This is a growing problem for a lot of companies. There's a proliferation of cloud products. Two very common ones that most people are aware of are Dropbox and Evernote. some IT departments will want to consider limiting access to those, because if your employee can upload your trade secrets, perhaps they want to work remotely, they want to do an offline presentation, they upload those trade secrets to those other providers. Not only have you lost control of protection of those trade secrets, but now that information is subject to the terms of service that your employee automatically hit accept on when they sign up for that service. You're also going to want to implement policies and train your employees. Implementing policies is something many companies do well. Actually training their employees on safe use, transport, and access of data is something most companies overlook. So consider that, especially in this exploding world of bring your own device. The next step to take would be monitoring access and downloading of files. The major benefit of this is to take immediate action if something is going awry. I'll note that the FBI, which has a big cyber espionage unit, tries to warn companies about the warning signs of insider threat or other suspicious activity. Folks in in-house departments will want to think about how to have processes in place that don't invade employees' potential privacy rights, but that are on the lookout for sensitive information that might be leaked. For example, odd work hours, taking proprietary information home, installing personal software on company equipment, short trips to other countries, sudden influx of wealth, things of that nature are the things that the FBI has flagged. You're going to want to require confidentiality and NDA agreements with your employees and ensure that those extend beyond termination. I'll do a footnote here on those. I see many confidentiality and NDA agreements that do not contain attorney fee success fees. I highly recommend that because that can provide benefit to the company and protection should you find yourself in litigation. You want to consider conducting exit interviews to determine if the employee has inadvertently retained any information. And they provide the company an opportunity to instruct them to return it or destroy it. You'll want to collect and secure materials of terminated employees. Again, this falls in the bucket of it allows you to take immediate action if your IT folks look at the computer and see that certain things were deleted or copied. And then finally, and this is a little bit of a controversial one, you want to consider labeling materials trade secret or confidential. The pro of this is if you find yourself in litigation, it's an additional way to demonstrate to the judge that the item that you're seeking to protect warrants actual trade secret protection. The con of that is, you know, some say that provides a roadmap and simply flags what's sensitive or important for materials floating around on the cloud that may not be secured. But that's, again, a kind of an assumed risk that companies will want to think about on a case-by-case basis. All right, and finally, what to do in case of theft, loss, or breach? Five main steps include, first, to secure the information and assess the damage. You're going to want to remove or lock down your trade secrets. The IT department can partition off access, but whatever you do, you want to act very, very quickly about this, not only to mitigate the actual damage, but to demonstrate that you took prompt action so that you can support your argument for trade secret status. You're going to want to pursue cease and desist letters or enforce other confidentiality agreements or NDAs. These are expensive, they're time-consuming, but they, again, help support the argument for trade secrets. You're going to want to determine whether the individual notice is required or client notice is required. Several entities, folks working for several entities on the phone, will be governed by the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act. Some might be governed by California SB 1, which expands Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act protections, and some might simply be governed by state breach notice requirements. Those requirements typically require that the most expeditious notice is provided without unreasonable delay. You're also going to want to notify your insurers, not only to ensure timely notice so the insurer doesn't potentially deny coverage, but you want to get your insurer involved if you have cyber coverage, because that cyber coverage can provide for things like forensic analysis, crisis management expenses, restoration, and notification expenses, all of which you want to have happen right away. And then finally, you're going to want to reevaluate your company procedures and agreements, policies, training, and make sure you get the participation of everybody. It's a group project. But I've seen companies have losses of trade secrets or other information that causes them harm, and there's not a sufficient continuous process improvement in place to ensure that it doesn't happen again. Technology and best practices are constantly evolving, so it requires a strong degree of vigilance. And with that, I will hand it over to Scott.
Thank you, Rebecca. And now we'll talk about what happens when you find yourself in that fortunate or unfortunate position of having to prosecute or litigate with someone or a competitor because your trade secrets are now with a competitor or with someone who is going to a competitor are taken from the cloud and now in the public forum. But before we do that, let us give you the CLE code for today, and that is SS2135. SS, so Safar Shaw, 2135. So what are your options if you're in the financial services industry? Well, you have to start somewhere, and usually the first place we start are employment agreements. What do they say about restrictive covenants and confidentiality provisions? Do they say that these people cannot take confidential information with them? Do they say that you're allowed to go after them through litigation and non-litigation means? And with respect to litigation, we refer to injunctions, temporary restraining orders, interlocutory injunctions, permanent injunctions. What is also becoming more and more noticeable, not prominent, but noticeable, is the fact that the federal government and state governments are getting involved in. And so there are, when we talk about non-civil litigation revenues, our avenues, you can, in certain cases, go to the district attorney's office or the U.S. attorney's office, and they may investigate the theft of your trade secrets and, in certain situations, prosecute those offenders. The statutes that you can use from a civil standpoint is the Trade Secrets Act, the Uniform Trade Secrets Act that Jason talked about earlier, as well as the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which is really a hacking statute, which basically says if you go into the computer system of another for illegal motives or to do something wrong, such as stealing a confidential customer list, and the company sustains a certain level of damage, then you can proceed under in federal court under the CFFAA, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. The two additional acts, and these are solely for prosecutors, are the Espionage Act and the National Stolen Property Act. The Espionage Act, as it sounds, really became a spy act, and that's why it was introduced 40-some years ago to combat. The National Stolen Property Act was really designed originally for paintings, to recover stolen art. But those two acts have since grown and morphed into other things. And for those of you that are familiar with the Sergei Alenikov case, he was the Goldman trader who was going to a competitor and was flying from Chicago to LaGuardia and arrested at the LaGuardia airport by the FBI for stealing Goldman's trade secrets. These were the two acts that the government prosecuted him under, the Espionage Act and the National Stolen Property Act. Mr. Alenikov was convicted in 2010. He was his conviction was overturned on appeal in 2012. And in a very unusual move, the federal U.S. Attorney's Office declined to not prosecute him, but then the state of New York, the District Attorney's Office of Manhattan, chose to file an action against him, criminal action under New York statute. That case is still going on. However, 2 weeks ago now, the judge threw out all of the evidence, or just about all the evidence in the case. So it'll be interesting to see if the saga that Mr. Alenikov has gone through over the last 4 years is finally coming to an end. We mentioned injunctions, and what those are for people who aren't familiar are basically orders from courts that will prevent somebody from doing something. In other words, it'll prevent somebody from going to work for a competitor. It will prevent someone from using their former employer's trade secrets. What those will not do is they will not return your customers. They will not order customers back to you. But what you can do for those customers that you've lost is you can retain lost profits, the diminished value of the trade secret, in certain circumstances, reasonable royalties, the damage to your goodwill and benefits. And I should also add that depending on the type of case and depending on what's written in, for say, a employment agreement, you may be able to recover attorney's fees. For example, if you have an attorney's fees provision in your employment agreement, or if you can show willful and wanton conduct under the Trade Secrets Act, you have an avenue for recovering your attorney's fees. But that is what you would see before you then say, well, what about FINRA? Because as most of you on the phone know, is that if you are a registered broker and you have a dispute with another registered broker, you have to go through FINRA. Or at least a lot of times when you have someone who has stolen your trade secrets or taken a customer list or is violating a non-compete by soliciting their customers, that they'll say, well, we have to go through FINRA. We can't go through the court system. And that's, for initial matters, not exactly true. What FINRA does allow you to do under Rule 13804 is file a TRO and a FINRA action simultaneously. So Jason and I are sitting here in Chicago. If we had a client that was located here in Chicago and had a employee leave and go to, say, New York, we could file an action in federal court or New York to enjoin that person from going to work for that competitor or from going to that competitor using our trade secrets. Simultaneously, we'd have to file the FINRA complaint or the statement of claim electronically with FINRA. And what happens then is if the TRO is granted, we are required, the plaintiff, so Jason and I in this example, are required then to notify the FINRA panel of the TRO. The FINRA panel will then convene within 15 days, and they'll decide what to do with that TRO. And what I mean by that is they could say, we like the TRO, we're going to keep it in place for 6 months, a year. They could say, we think the TRO is too much, so we're going to say he can go work for that competitor, he just can't use your confidential information. Or they could say, you know what, we don't like this TRO, we think he should be allowed to work for that competitor and use your confidential information, so that's that. So the FINRA panel is the ultimate authority on trade secret and non-compete disputes between industry members or between brokers. And that's important to know. But just a little, you know, litigation or tactical note, for the most part, FINRA panels are going to follow your judge's ruling. I won't go so far as to say it's fairly rare, but it's pretty uncommon for a FINRA panel to throw out a judge's decision, especially because when a petition and TRO are granted for injunctive relief, a court is required to lay out the basis for their opinion and why they are granting that injunction. So if you get your injunction and then you go to the FINRA panel, you can say, hey, FINRA panel, look, this is what the judge already found. This is already his analysis of the law, and this is why this TRO should be granted and continue to remain in place during the while that we are proceeding through FINRA. And that's pretty powerful stuff, even to a FINRA panel. A couple other things that we should point out is a lot of times we get asked questions of, well, why are they allowed to take customer accounts, or customers are allowed to go with them, and we can't have an order that requires those customers to go back? And the reason for that is found in the FINRA rules 11870 and 2140, which basically say that customers are allowed to follow their brokers and do business with the brokers that they want to do business with. So that's why if you get an ACAT form or a core transfer form, you have to honor it. And you cannot have those customers ordered back either through the court system or through a FINRA arbitration panel. But what 2140 and 11870 do provide is they specifically say that you can recover money damages for any breach of an agreement. So let's say now that you file your action, you've handled your TRO, or you've decided to forego the TRO process and are now in FINRA. What's the key differences? As I like to say, the major difference is whereas a court is formal, FINRA is the wild, wild west. It's pretty much anything goes. The rules of evidence don't apply. You do not get depositions except for one limited circumstance, and that is when a witness cannot come before the panel. You are allowed to take that witness's testimony. Otherwise, you don't get your normal round of depositions or expert depositions that you normally get in the court system. The other big reason why it's a bit of the wild, wild west is because where you have a judge ruling on the law and applying the law to the facts of the case, for FINRA, you typically have a three-person panel, of which no more than one is a lawyer. Now, if you went back 4 or 5 years ago, you hear a lot of people who handle FINRA arbitrations tell you that they didn't even have a lawyer in this on their panel, that it was three industry members. Now FINRA, and pretty much the last two and a half years, FINRA has made more of a conscious effort to place a lawyer on the panel. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're a trade secrets lawyer or a non-compete lawyer. A lot of times you might have a will and estates lawyer or a real estate lawyer. And so therefore, you always have to be wary of arbitrator justice, because the arbitration panel does not have to, unlike a judge or a jury, follow the law or follow the facts of the case and apply them to the law. The arbitrators can sort of decide, hey, what do we think is fair here? What do we think is the right thing to do? And then go ahead and do it. And then lastly, there's what's been called, or what is called, excuse me, the protocol for broker recruiting, which throws additional wrinkle into what we've talked about earlier today with respect to litigation between FINRA members. What the protocol for broker recruiting is basically a document that's been signed by about 1,100 brokerage houses that has said, in essence, we're going to allow you to take certain things with you from one competitor to another, and we're going, and that includes customer lists, customer names, information like that. And if you do, that will be okay, and you promise not to sue us either in court or in FINRA for taking that customer information. As you see here from this slide, it was originally started in 2004 by Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, and UBS, but as of last week, it had over 1,100 signatories, which is about double the number it had only 2 years ago. If you need a copy of it, or if you're looking to see if someone is a FINRA signatory to the protocol, you can do that by contacting FINRA. And if your company wants to join in the protocol, then you contact FINRA, you fill out the form, and you're now a member of the protocol. The thing that we have seen over the years is that when people sign up for the protocol, or when they have a lot of pressure from their business departments or from their brokers to sign up for the protocol, they don't always understand what it does, or more importantly, what it does to their agreements with respect to confidentiality agreements and restrictive covenants. As I mentioned earlier, they are specifically allowed to take the client's name, address, telephone number, email address, and account title. They can take that information with them to a competitor, even if your specific agreements that you've signed with them says that that information is your information, that that information is your property, and that they will not use that at any point in time after their employment or relationship with you ends. The protocol negates that right in your agreements, and so that's why it's important to understand, if you're going to join the protocol, the impact the protocol will have on your business, because when you sign it, you're basically saying they're allowed to take this, they're allowed to compete, and as mentioned here in the second bullet point, they're allowed to solicit your clients. Now, there is a case going on right now through FINRA. It was filed on June 30th between Credit Suisse and JP Morgan Securities, where they are both members of the protocol, and the litigation was over the employees at Credit Suisse who took more than these four bullet point information, and did that violate the protocol, or more importantly, from JP Morgan Securities' perspective, does that go beyond the protocol that allows the person what they can and they cannot take? The court said yes. The court said that they went too far and entered their injunction, but now they're in FINRA, and obviously everybody's waiting to see what the FINRA panel says about that. Because, as we mentioned here, if you only take that information, and if you're a member of the protocol, your employer, your company cannot go after these people for either damages or injunctive relief. They're allowed to take that information, and they're allowed to solicit your customers. So then the question becomes is, okay, well, what do we have now with respect to protocol member versus protocol member, protocol plaintiff versus non-protocol defendant, are what are commonly referred to as signatories to the protocol, signatory plaintiff, and non-signatory defendant. Well, the courts have taken an interesting view of the protocol. What the courts have basically said, and what the court said in the Credit Suisse case, was if you have two signatories to this protocol, the plaintiff and the defendant, in this case JP Morgan Securities and Credit Suisse, are both members to the protocol, we're going to follow it. And so Credit Suisse, if they only took the client names, the addresses, and telephone numbers, that's that. We will honor the protocol. What the courts have also said, though, which is interesting and significant, is if you've signed the protocol, they're going to apply the protocol to you in any non-compete case you or confidentiality trade secret case you file, even if it's against a non-signatory defendant. So, for example, if Rebecca here is a signatory company and I am a non-signatory company and I poach her people, even though I'm not a signatory defendant, the courts have said, well, Rebecca, you guys have said that this information isn't worthy of confidential trade secret protection by signing the protocol. Therefore, Scott's allowed to hire those people, and Scott's allowed to take and use that confidential information, those customer names and addresses, for when those employees leave Rebecca and come to you. And I should also say that the converse of that, though, is not true. So, for example, in my example, if I were to sue Rebecca because she poached some of my people, Rebecca couldn't then use the protocol against me to say, well, listen, they're allowed to take this information with them and they're allowed to solicit their customers because I signed the protocol. The courts have said, no, this is simply a one-way street. If you sign the protocol, you own the protocol. But if you don't sign the protocol, then it's as if it doesn't exist. And so that's why, now for the third time, it's important to understand what the protocol has and what it can do to your confidentiality obligations, your restrictive covenants, and where a lot of times you have found this. And although the merger and acquisition bubble is starting to recede a little bit, it's not as active as it has been in past years. This is a where you saw a lot of tension between merging companies are the acquirer and the acquiree was when one company was a signatory to the protocol and one wasn't. And it's obviously something that if you're looking to acquire a small brokerage house that you need to do your due diligence on, because if that brokerage house has become one of those 1,100 members to the protocol, you need to know that and you need to understand the impact that will have on your merger and whether you need specific language in your merger, negating that agreement or somehow modifying it or just frankly, as I said, negating or doing away with it. So that is our presentation for the day. We'll open this up for questions in a few minutes. But again, and I think Rebecca really did a nice job of talking about this as Jason, the most important thing for these issues is to not let it get to me. To not let it get to what I've talked about, where you are talking about somebody stealing your confidential information, somebody downloading information off the cloud, or doing it the old-fashioned way of coming in on a Sunday evening and hitting print as often as they could to get everything off of your internal database. Take the steps that you need to take to protect that information now, not after the horse has left the barn, not after they've walked out the door with your confidential information or after they've downloaded that information from the cloud onto a flash drive and now it's being used against you by a competitor. So with that, we'll pause for a minute. Take any questions you have.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will conduct the question and answer session. As a reminder, to ask a question via the web presentation, select the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen. Then type your question and click send. We are now ready to begin. Scott or Jason or Rebecca, do you have a frequently asked question that you can go over?
We can, but we'll answer some in the queue first. One is, can you circulate a copy of the Credit Suisse versus JP Morgan matter? Unfortunately, we cannot, but if you Google it, you will find it very easily and very quickly. I would also tell you is that you can also, when and if a case ever comes to fruition where the FINRA panel makes a ruling on it that's public, you can find it on the FINRA database for published opinions. I should have pointed this out in the very beginning. You know, obviously one of the benefits to FINRA arbitration, and this is a commonly asked question as opposed to litigation, is speed. Whereas in a lot of jurisdictions, you are looking at a lifespan of 2 years for a normal case, 14 to 18 months for a trade secrets case after the injunction phase. Here, the typical length of a FINRA case over the last couple of years has been just over 12 months, about 13 months. Also, the hearing, the percentage-wise of cases actually go to hearing are about 18%, which is up a tad bit, only about 1% over the last 2 years. So the FINRA cases have maintained relatively stable, which is interesting because if you look at the non-compete trade secret explosion that Jason talked about earlier, how it's been doubling over every 10 years, and we suspect that there'll be even more cases filed this year than in 2013 or 2012, it hasn't quite reached the level of FINRA intervention, and I think the reason for that is a lot of times when you do the TRO route, the parties will sit down after the TRO hearing and work something out. There also was a request for the CLE code, and it is SS, so S as in Sam, S as in Sam, 2135. One of the other questions that's been asked is this a typical federal law issue or state law issue? And the answer is that they are both. What I mean by that is if you get into the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, you can have federal court jurisdiction. That's obviously federal case law. Non-compete law, though, in general, is a state-by-state jurisdictional issue. And so, as most of you know, agreement that is enforceable in Illinois may not be enforceable in New Jersey and is probably not enforceable in California. With respect to the Uniform Trade Secrets Act that we talked about, even though that is state court law, pretty much everybody with the exception of Massachusetts and New York follow the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. So even though that's a body of state law, it's pretty consistent throughout the 50 states, whereas non-compete law is not. So when you go to FINRA, that's additional issue that you have when we talked about who's really deciding your case. Is it a judge applying the law and the facts, or is it arbitrators, non-lawyers who are trying to do the right thing? That's another issue that you face, is educating the panel about the case law and where it goes and where it goes with respect to the specific state. Another question is tips on protecting trade secrets and responding to discovery as judges will decide what is considered a trade secret. That's a really good question, and it's very important. You know, obviously, the first thing you should do whenever you're looking to file something is see what the rules are for filing something under seal. Each court has its own set of rules. I should say most courts have their specific sets of rules. And for the most part, especially in federal court, judges will allow you to file under seal when you are seeking trade secret protection status. With respect to discovery, then, when you have to produce more information on that, obviously the first thing you have to do is make sure that you have a solid protective order in place. And with respect to the protective order, it's important to go to the court's website first, because now you're seeing more and more jurisdictions and more judges have their own protective order that they want signed, or that they want to handle the case, and that you then have to follow. And they usually don't want you to modify it, or if they, or if you do try to modify it, they, you know, hesitate a little bit, or maybe begrudgingly will allow you to modify their order. So the first step with discovery is protecting the trade secret, getting the protective order in place, then making sure that everybody from the paralegal who's stamping the documents to the lawyers that are doing the final review, you're making sure that you're complying with the protective order. The other thing is, a lot of times you will find people filing, in Illinois it's called sort of a bill of particulars, or a more definite statement, where instead of answering the complaint, you have somebody say, I can't answer this because I don't know what they're asking for. They're just saying confidential information. They're not specifically identifying it. And the way that you can handle that in your pleadings, as well as in interrogatory answers, and then that are not filed under seal, or I should say that are not stamped confidential or under a protective order, is you just need to describe that information with reasonably solid information. And what I mean by that is, or to use an example, is to say is that this person used confidential and stole confidential information, including information related to our customers' names, addresses, and emails, as well as our trailing 12 our trailing 12s, as well as our programs and processes with respect to revenue projections for the company. That information, that label, or that blurb that I just gave, that's good enough to get by federal notice pleading standards. So another step, or another tip for protecting trade secrets, is in your complaint, you don't need to specifically attach the customer list, or you don't need to specifically attach the trailing 12 that they took. You just need to say they took a trailing 12, they took this confidential information. You describe it as follows. You go in on your TRO, you file the actual customer list under seal, and you handle it that way. And with that, I believe we've answered all of your questions. So on behalf of Rebecca, Jason, and myself, thank you very much for attending today's webinar. We hope that you found this to be helpful. If you have any questions or you have any follow-up questions, by all means, please do not hesitate to reach out to Jason, Rebecca, or myself. Our email addresses are on the slide that you see before you. And we look forward to answering any additional questions you have. And once again, thank you for your time.
And this concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.